Ever feel like there's a better way to build? So do we. I'm Matt, and welcome to the Mindful Builder podcast, where we believe in education through storytelling. Join me and my co-host Hamish as we both have a passion for building better, breaking barriers, and sharing our experience within the building industry. We're not pretending to know it all. In fact, we're learning right alongside you. Join us each week as we tackle complex topics like building science and mental well-being, inviting the brightest minds to connect curiosity with expertise. We want this to be a real conversation, encouraging vulnerability through honest discussions. So if you love this podcast and you're ready to join in, learn and build better, please do us a favor and subscribe wherever listening. It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode, plus it really helps us out. And if you're feeling extra generous, a 5-star rating and a quick review would be amazing. Your support helps us reach new listeners and even better, allows us to book incredible guests for the future episodes. Thank you so much for being part of our community. We truly appreciate you. And now on to this week's episode. Daniel, who are you?
I'm an architectural engineer. I build robots that build concrete things and do it in a more sustainable way.
All right, great. Thanks for coming.
So what do you mean? Do you build the robots or you create the concrete?
Both.
So so while you were outside on your phone call before, Matt, I had a really interesting conversation. So obviously, you know, I'm like to think of myself as a sustainable builder, and, you know, my ears sort of perked up when Matt said, I've got someone who's, you know, making low carbon concrete. So I reckon let's start there and maybe just explain to the listeners, like, what is it you do? Like, I've been using EcoPact concrete from Wholesome for a number of years and have been really happy with it, and I think it's a fantastic product. It's now specified on all our jobs, but yours is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about?
Yeah. So we've developed a low-carbon concrete, which is a geopolymer, is what we call it. It's used as waste byproducts that replace the cement, which is the, you know, polluting part of the mix design for standard concrete. It is a geopolymer that achieves 50 MPa grade strength for precast applications. So we're focused on the precast market, and CurveCrete is positioned in a way where we can then scale up our material to be utilized on infrastructure projects for noise walls and earth retaining walls and that sort of thing. And that's part of the reason why we're here at ArchiBuild.
Right. And when you say, like, they're quite specific projects, you know, we're Matt and I from like a residential point of view, but you're talking about, like, I can imagine, like, I'm driving down the Eastern Freeway and I see these big walls which are trying to stop noise transmission. Is that the kind of stuff that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so the, you know, noise walls is our big ambition to solve for freestanding wall elements that are, you know, 9-10 meters high. There's an abundance of them that are required for infrastructure around Australia. Here at the Big Build in Victoria, there's noise wall elements that are currently being created that are 300 millimeter thick flat elements, 9 meters high, 300 millimeters thick. There's a couple of innovations that I have to explain here. So that's the benchmark, 300 millimeters thick, 9 meters high. With the technology that we developed at CurveCrete, there's the low carbon concrete, right? So if we created one of those panels with our low carbon concrete, it'll avoid 70% of the emissions relative to standard concrete. But we also developed a robotic method that creates curved concrete elements. And the curved concrete elements are naturally much more stiff in their geometry. So you can use curvature to make the elements lighter.
Does that mean you can make them thinner?
Thinner, yeah.
And does the curve actually help with that sound deadening? And
it can help with the scattering effect of sound, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But that's not the primary reason why you're...
That's a bonus.
That's a bonus, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So the curvature enables a more structurally efficient design. It means the panels can be 150 millimeter thick instead of 300.
Wow. I didn't know. So curved concrete is stronger than straight concrete.
Yes.
That's... Now, why is it?
Concrete's really good in compression. So if you have a flat that, you know, everyone can do this exercise at home, you know, with a piece of paper. If it's a flat piece of paper, it's floppy, you know. If you fold it, it becomes a little bit more stiff. Or if you curve it, it also becomes stiff.
That makes sense. Right?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Even though it's a thin sheet of paper. So you use the same principle on concrete.
You talked about like this benchmark wall that you're comparative, that you're, you know, you talked about a 300 wide wall by 9 meters tall.
Yep.
And you're saying that your product is 70% less carbon.
Yep. In the material itself.
Yeah, okay, in the material itself. Okay, so it's not in, because yours are 150 mil thick.
Mm.
So there's obviously less material, mm-hmm. so ultimately less carbon. But you're saying it's even lower mm-hmm. because you can have less product and it's 70%. Yeah, okay.
Correct.
All right, cool.
All right, so we go to 85% less
yep.
now.
Yeah, then a comparative.
Mm. Yep. So 70% is within the product and the rest is remaining the way that you construct.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Okay. And are you reducing the cement through flash and slag? Or?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Well, you're eliminating the cement because you've got geopolymer.
I thought you can't eliminate 100% cement.
You can.
Yeah, because you're using a different. So yeah. While you're outside on your phone, we're talking about a company in Queensland called Wagners.
Mm.
Yeah, and they've actually got a geopolymer, yeah. And there's no cement in it.
So what's a geopolymer? That it's a. Yeah. Is it like a plastic?
No. It's a common misconception because the polymer's in the name, right?
Yeah.
But the geo is what counts.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So the geo part of it is actually a mineral substance. It's more like rock. It's usually a metal with a metal oxide with some carbon atoms attached to it and that sort of thing. Or silica. So, you know, a geopolymer primarily in its chemistry is an alumina silicate. You know, it creates these sort of gels that are based on those materials rather than the polymers, which are hydrocarbons.
Right? So it's like a more rigid, is it more fluid structure compared to a rigid structure?
It's very similar to concrete. It's rigid. A polymer can be like flexed and ductile,
yep.
But a geopolymer is very much more like a rock. It's an artificial rock, just like concrete.
And so why is Portland cement then bad?
Two reasons. One is that you have to heat it to high temperatures, go through this process of creating clinker. That uses a lot of energy. But the second thing is almost unavoidable, is within the chemistry itself, when you do heat it, it releases carbon dioxide in the process. And if you combine those two processes, 8% of all global emissions, so 4% from the heating of the cement, and another 4% from the emission of CO2 in that chemistry process. Second most used substance on the planet to water is emitting, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's such a fucking good product. Mm. Like, it's such an amazing
material.
We pour
that much concrete. We pour the amount to build Manhattan per week. Is that right? Something on,
yeah,
something
like that.
Crazy yeah. amount of concrete. Like, yeah. It's literally everywhere you see. So I want to go back. Where did... Mm. Are you a chemical engineer? What's your background?
My background, I put it mostly on my father as an electronic engineer who, you know, from a young age, I got exposed to creating electrical circuits and things. Some of the toys that I made, a remote control boat. My dad didn't just buy the components that we could build the remote control boat. He showed me a design of a circuit for, you know, radio receiver. And I soldered it myself and had to figure out the circuitry when I was about 13 years old. So I created my first circuit board there and then built all sorts of things, you know, always building things, furniture out in the garage, designing them, introduced to CAD, you know, computer-aided design when I was 17 through my graphic design teacher at school. I was like, oh, this is cool, can do things in 3D, and had a passion for architecture. That put me on this journey in academia because I got accepted to aerospace engineering.
He's a real engineer. He's a real engineer.
You know, you're a smart bookie.
loved math. You know, that was...
What do we call Cam?
Rocket scientist.
Rocket scientist. Yeah, rocket scientist.
Anyway, there's a lot of history there, but in a nutshell, aerospace eng, civil eng, and architecture all sort of combined academically and helped found the architectural engineering course at Swinburne University, which I still lecture at and teach the the young architectural engineers, and we're trying to build, you know, Australia's capability in architectural engineering, because that's where all the design integration and innovation happens in the industry. Yeah.
Could you maybe just define architectural engineering? Because, I mean, usually they're split up. You got an architect and you got an engineer.
So who don't talk.
Yeah.
Well, occasionally.
Well, they talk loudly at each other.
Yeah. So what does that mean? So architectural engineer.
I'll name drop Simon De Silva because he mentored me as a young lecturer at RMIT when I was there. And he used to say the building, you want to take this hand-in-glove approach, right? So the architecture is the hand and the glove is the engineer or the structural engineering, and it's they should work as one. So the architecture side of it is all the human side of how you make buildings work. The engineering side is all the technology and stuff that makes the architecture function. And when you have all of that floating around in one brain rather than two separate brains, you can begin to sort of iterate in between those two things and set goals for the human aspects of the design and make the functional things sort of achieve that. So in a very general way, that's the way of thinking.
Yeah.
So within like Swinburne's architectural engineering degree, they learn structures, but they don't learn it from using a similar approach to civil engineering. While they do the fundamentals and design a beam in isolation in some cases with the civil engineering portion of it, we teach how to design the entire building as a system, as a structural system that can be pushed and pulled and, you know, adjusted as the design iterates. Yeah. So then you can adjust it to the human requirements.
Yeah.
With light and heat and et cetera.
So you walk out as into this degree, are you able to register yourself on the architect board or an engineering board or what?
It's an engineering board.
Okay.
So it's a fully accredited Engineers Australia degree.
So I was just thinking, because we've interviewed an architect today, right? And so this is a couple of thoughts running through my brain. First thought is, it's such a practical approach when you put those two things together because there's synergy between the two.
Yeah.
I think one of the limiting things that come to my mind, though, is that you actually remove some of the creativity that architects then are allowed to kind of flourish in when they're not limited by the practical engineering side of things.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying one's better than the other because I think both have merit. From a builder's point of view, I love the whole architecture engineer thing because
it makes so much sense.
Mm. But then I think if we hadn't talked to Danny today, I wouldn't have even brought this up. I love the fact that they spend 5 years at uni and they just say, just let your brain be free and create and do all those crazy things. I mean, I don't know where I'm going with this. It just happens to have been like these two thoughts that came to my mind then that both have merit.
Mm. Well, you know, we need architects to challenge engineers to create what needs to be created for society. I feel architects' responsibility to do that. I think sometimes they, you know, actually are maybe, you know, holding back a little bit with some engineers. Like, you know, you've got to keep the pressure on and get them to innovate.
Yeah.
And really be comfortable with something that's more interesting.
And that's good because everyone's kind of forcing everyone to step outside of their comfort zone. So then you get these amazing results. I mean, I love that you're kind of talking about that middle part though, that the real practical space where everyone kind of comes together and it's actually can be achievable. Because I think a lot of ideas just remain ideas, whereas yours is like the idea and the solution.
So
the robotics part, talk to me about that. What is, if you developed a robot that makes the formwork or?
It is the formwork.
Hang on. The robot is the formwork.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm confused.
Yeah, so formwork wants to be rigid, right? So that's the challenge. But to just explain it, what are we doing? We're casting concrete, traditional casting method, right, into a form. But that form has multiple different shapes that it could be in. So essentially it's an adjustable or adaptable formwork, moves, different curved shapes.
Fucking brilliant.
So you're actually using, so maybe I'm going to break this right back down. So you've got formwork that is a robot that will just essentially move to whatever you want the robot to hold itself as, and then you pour it.
Correct.
And the next time, like, you take the concrete out, and then on the next pour, it could be different shape of that exact same bit of formwork.
Correct.
And that does not require any, like, and manual labor to make the formwork.
I mean, this is fucking genius, because all you're then doing is telling the computer what it to be, and the robot's just doing that.
Yep.
Okay.
So well, could we then see
formwork? Is there an opportunity to invest in this company?
So you could essentially wipe out all formwork for construction workers.
I grab a term sheet.
Yeah, okay.
So you could potentially
what's the minimum investment?
Could you wipe out all formwork construction labor in the future?
I mean, possibly. So
in a controlled environment, I would say there's an opportunity for sure.
My mind splits in two when you ask that question, because technically, yes. But then commercially, how does that work?
I was going to say, if we do it even commercial sector, that's one of the biggest types of construction or trades on site is formwork.
Yeah.
I wonder how they're going to go if you're like, no, we're going to cut all the jobs and we can do this. Because you could significantly reduce price, because we know labor is one of the most biggest components.
You know, if it's a company like Form 700 or Perry, formworking systems, like they've got their systems, right? And they've got to be marketing in situ, formwork. You know, we could go into that.
Yeah.
What we're focusing on is precast at the moment.
Yeah, so you can wipe the whole precast. Sorry, I should refer back, change my comment. You could change a whole precast environment.
You're shaking it up. Like you're disrupting it.
Yes.
So at the moment you're talking about like sound barriers, right?
Mm-hmm. Even warehouses.
This is my next thing. Like, I mean, you're talking about the curvature allows you to make more efficient designs, but could you then apply that same logic to like a precast factory?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So we have our own factory in West Footscray. We're producing product.
We're in West Footscray. I mean,
oh yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, come by.
Are you down towards Tottenham Way, or are you at the back end?
No, Tottenham. Yeah. 500 square meter facility there. It's our prototyping facility actually now, but we produce product out of it. We're currently working with the M80 team on the North East Link to produce some earth-retaining walls, which are actually on show here today. I'll go into that in a bit more detail in a sec. But, we're producing urban furniture. We're producing earth-retaining walls. Yeah, we're producing product already. The noise walls, the bigger elements, that's where our ambition lies to go, and we're doing that. In partnership with Advanced Precast.
Yeah.
So
I'd love to just know a little bit more about the mix. Like I just think about like how like concrete just work the concrete and they wait for it to dry to a certain point before they can start finishing and stuff like that. What is the process with your product?
It's actually very similar.
So you are able to potentially remove steel as well from your your concrete and then really reduce carbon footprint.
Yeah. So the challenge with us at Curvecrete is that we're continuously optimizing things and we need to create that clear narrative of what we're doing. I haven't delved into that, so that's a really good question though.
Yeah.
We've managed to demonstrate that you can actually eliminate a lot of the steel reinforcement in concrete as well by utilizing rock as the reinforcement, which sounds funny, but basalt is the rock that you can use when you melt down basalt and stretch it into long strands. You can create basalt reinforcement, and it's got a higher tensile capacity than steel. It's lower density than steel, so you end up with this compounding effect where you got about an 88% reduction in carbon emissions from the comparison of those metrics. So steel versus the equivalent strength in basalt Rio, 88% reduction in carbon emission.
What's the catch here? I feel like it's all too good to be true.
Where my brain
goes is like, but why isn't this now just like what everyone's going to?
Yeah, it's just a different way of engineering the system.
So
the standards since 1850, are steel reinforced concrete. Everyone's familiar with it. They get it.
Yeah, it's easy to come at. Yeah,
but you need some driving factor to change, like some significant driving factor for these types of concrete structures. In Canada and other regions where you've got freeze-thaw issues where cracks open up. Basalt reinforcement is really, really good because it doesn't corrode.
Concrete cancer's gone, eliminated.
Yeah. So in environments like that, it's really essential to solve that problem.
Yeah.
So they use those types of systems. But here we don't have that issue as much.
I want to go back to the basalt thing because it kind of makes sense because mineral is...
Yeah, spun rock.
It's spun rock.
Correct.
It holds itself together.
So surely that whole process, though, is incredibly energy exhaustive. So, like, the actual, like, process of creating this basalt reinforcement is hugely, you know...
Energy intensive.
But what you're saying, just to confirm, is that it's less intensive than...
Than steel.
Than steel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's still some embodied carbon there, but it's a better...
It's way less, yeah.
How?
Because you can look at it as simplest perspective is just look at the density of the material. So density of steel is, you know, 7.8 specific gravity, whereas...
I knew that one off the top of my head too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, from memory, yes.
Basalt's 2.7. Okay. So,
Of course. All right. Well, you know what? Pennies dropped now.
It's 2.5 times lighter.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
So then you know, if a lighter substance, less atoms, you know, so less heating.
Yeah. Okay.
So does that mean, and that's assuming that you're not using renewables or something to create that too. Like if you had renewables, you don't need as much to get there too.
No.
Yeah, okay. All right. So we've solved all the problem now. We've got rid of Rio. We've got rid of Portland cement. So why isn't this everywhere?
I think the big challenges commercially are, well, how do you scale up these low-carbon concretes where you have like a training overhead or, you know, some other different safety procedure or, testing that's required prior.
That's politics.
The big cement manufacturers, you know, Cement Australia and their people, their technical department's awesome. Like we chat to them all the time. Their sustainability department, we get along with them really, really well.
Yeah.
They're all really enthusiastic to do things. But then when it comes to getting it done actually, it's a little bit slower.
Okay.
So what we've done is we've looked at, well, you know, can we work with independents? And start to...
Like a Wholesome or like a Boral or something like that or even...
No, smaller.
Okay, even smaller again.
Yeah.
Well, mate, Wholesome's global.
Yeah, Wholesome in Victoria. They're like not like... I think Pronto's the biggest in Victoria.
Yeah, but Wholesome is a global company.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, so...
So is Boral actually.
Yeah.
Boral as well, yeah. So, and Heidelberg Materials or Hanson. We work with them. We work with, Master Builders and Sika and these sort of producers of raw material as well. Like it's all pretty collaborative, but then when it gets to the large commercial scale, it's quite difficult to navigate. So the best that we can do is demonstrate that it can be used, get specifiers to specify these types of new materials and put pressure on the industry at large to use it more.
And is that the reason why I guess you're then targeting, like I would see that these sound infrastructure is a product.
Yeah.
Is that why you've kind of targeted that at this point in time? Because then there's a proof of concept.
That's kind of like a North Star product.
Okay.
So we worked with Arup as well, I should mention.
Yeah.
They helped us a lot with, engineering the system to the point where it can be, specified. So they proved out that, you know, we could reduce the material by half and, you know, have all the reinforcement detailing and everything.
There seems like there's a lot of red tape that you got to go through.
Yeah.
My mind like immediately goes to, well, why aren't I pouring this concrete next week in my residential slab?
And that's where my brain, like,
I'm just like, why aren't we just doing this? Because if you, like, just sitting with you now, like, is enough for me to go, right, well, that makes all the sense.
Mm.
But I guess if I think about all of the infrastructure that's around us at the moment is purely based around that using Portland cement.
Mm.
We've got plants. Mm. We put it in the back of a concrete truck and then we deliver it to site.
Mm.
Like that network's all already there and existing. I'd imagine it would be like, because the opportunities for you guys are endless. Mm. Like
Like, why isn't all cut? This is why I've asked the question before. Like, why don't it just get rid of normal concrete and just only use low carbon concrete?
Well, I'd said this on, like, I was just saying this, before you came in, Matt. That, you know, I drive past that, you know, where that main hub of all the buzz is with this new tunnels and links that we're, you know, that we've got at the moment. And there's a Boral plant right in the middle in Bulleen.
Mm.
And I had a thought the other day as I was driving past, and I thought, I wonder why they're not using low carb concrete on all of this concrete infrastructure that's going in.
Mm.
And I guarantee that it's not happening. Mm. It's just the same old stuff.
Yeah.
And why is it not mandated that it's low carbon? Because there are tons, like tens of millions of tons of concrete that they're putting in there.
Mm.
It actually really frustrates me. It's just like, just roll with the new one, because once you have more like supply of it, the cost comes down.
Exactly.
We're just going to make that one obsolete now because it's outdated and we've got a better technology.
Are you just targeting a product? And in my mind, a precast panel is a product rather than going, all right, well, we're going to try and target every single plant that's out there and have their trucks filled with our concrete. You're like, we can provide you a solution. Here's the solution for this problem. And it's quite specific. It's a precast panel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's easier for you guys to focus on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But ultimately, your market is infinite.
Yeah.
Like, we could use a seat in a slab.
Yeah. The challenge that is faced with these things, to be real, is that if you've got a in-situ concrete supplier that deals with concrete and they're just churning it out, you know, they've got their supply contracts, they've got, you know, they know how to work the material, these sort of things. They don't have training overheads and these sort of things. So, you know, there's a training overhead. There's
It's the same concrete. Like, we've used it. My concrete, I reckon, have no idea about the difference.
Yeah, but I see where you're coming from, though, because, like, because there is that, there's a real, fear. Like, change here that needs to happen.
It's just the unfamiliarity of it from the specifier's perspective. I think that it comes down to. So I'm in the nitty-gritty of, how do we inform concrete suppliers about not using cement at all and also educating the specifiers at the same time to say, you can specify this. You don't have to specify just standard concrete. If it gets too far in that design process or specification process and then the alternative comes in, that sort of consultancy overhead, you know, doesn't exist on projects. So the money doesn't get spent on trying to change something. It's just, it's already done. So there's two angles that we have to attack, essentially.
So, like, maybe enough dumbing down's the right term, but dumb it down. So if, hypothetically speaking, your product was taking the place of Portland cement. And and is that the component in the mix that you're replacing?
Yes.
Okay, so remove Portland cement, input yours into that supply chain. So two-part question.
Mm.
Does the rest of their infrastructure and delivery of it change, or is it the same?
The infrastructure slightly changes because with our mix design, you're using slag and fly ash rather than cement.
Yeah.
So, you know, some batching plants might have, you know, just a silo for cement.
Yeah.
Maybe just a silo for, you know, fly ash or something.
Yeah.
Maybe they need to introduce another silo for the slag.
Okay. And this is what I was getting at before, because there's all those costs as well.
So it's the investment from the plant.
Exactly.
But then you go back to your Boral comment where they've just made one on the new freeway. Like, why isn't it just like, that's what we're making?
Yeah.
But then, you know, if you give the example, like we've been doing a little bit of back and forth with GeoQuest up in Albury, their Hanson facility or Hotterberg Materials facility, that has cement, slag and fly ash there already. But that was because GeoQuest Hanson, but you know, GeoQuest pushed them to put it in there because they really want to do it. So the pressures from precasters or other builders potentially, and in situ concreters, if they pressure the raw material suppliers to yep. change their facilities, they'll change it yep. if the demand is there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay.
And so we're here to like build that demand.
Yeah, okay. So you're now creating demand. So my second question yeah. is, if you know there's this demand and magically tomorrow mm. everyone's like, well, you know what, we're just going to be using your concrete.
Mm.
Do you have the supply chain for it?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
And I'm assuming this is like a synthetic kind of. So you've got the fly ash, and then mm. what you're, I know you can't talk about your special sauce.
The secret sauce.
So yeah. is that like just easily manufactured?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's no brainer. Now we need to wrap this one up. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is exciting. Yeah. Yeah. This is exciting.
I had an announcement, by the way.
Yeah. Go. What's the announcement?
Breaking news now.
So
breaking news.
Yeah. Breaking news. Literally just got an email a couple of hours ago from my patent attorney. And the patent that we're applying for our robotic technology, the adaptive mold, after 7 years, just got granted.
Congratulations. Wow.
So there's a huge certificate there.
I mean, you can certificate of grant. You can show it to the...
That is. That yeah. is pretty cool.
Wow.
There you go.
Jeez, we're dropping
all the bombs here.
Jackie Falgate.
That's unreal. Hey, look, I'm excited... You know, right now we're surrounded by a pretty innovative product, even though it's been around forever, you know, DuraPanel. You know, we're talking to you now of a low-carbon concrete. You know, for me, I don't know, concrete. I love it and I hate it at the same time. Like it
solves the problem that we have concerns
with. Yeah, yeah, you know, it's there forever. This, for me, I don't know, this is the future.
Mm.
It's amazing. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming, mate.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cool.